Well, you were talking about your sophomore year. I think the problem came at that point. You were carrying such a heavy load and the job.
Yes. I turned out I was working as much as 40 with Brown and everything. By my junior year, I was working, you know, almost up to 40 hours a week. And I knew, though, what I was doing from 8 in the morning till 8 at night, the 6 days. But I could go home Sundays if I wanted to, much of the time I did. And being older, I was stronger physically, you know, was able to do things. I had a good rooming house in the, between the restaurant and the university. And I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I had my plans to get my doctorate degree, you see, relatively early. And I went on through, and...
Can you tell me something about the faculty? What was the department
right.
like when you were there?
Okay. One of the things that, well, that brought me back teaching in due time was that I had... pretty good teachers, and very good teachers in some of them, and others were not that bad. They were all professional. All the teachers I had were professional people. I had Brown, of course, and he was an engineer who really, and he taught me my combustion engineering materials, balance, material balance calculations, and that's when I really enjoyed it. And he made me his assistant a year later, you see. I had Professor Baker, who was interested in electroplating. He was a chief engineer of Houdai Hershey Company in Illinois, Decatur, Illinois, and he, as well as being a teacher. Professor McCabe, Warren McCabe, was my teacher, and he was a modern day type teacher. He showed us material balances and optimization, and this concept of the. Availability of energy. He'd gotten an award later for his concepts there that he had published. And of course the McCabe-Thiele diagram for distillation. So he was a relatively famous person himself. A.H. White, our chairman, was president. While I, in 1929, I was aware as a student that my teacher in organic chemistry was president of the American Chemical Society, Professor Gomberg,
and
the head of our department in chem engineering was the president of the American Institute of Chem Engineers. And I was aware of it at the time.
They were both presidents at the same time.
They were presidents at the same time, and I was their student. But I did not have A.H. White as a teacher, but only as chairman. Mm-hmm. But he had seminars. He conducted our seminars.
You had I don't mean to interrupt, but you had Gomberg as a teacher of organic.
Yes, I did.
Could you tell me something about him?
Well, he was very quiet and modest. For example, when he was president of the American Chemical Society, he said to the people in his department, when the applications for memberships, they get two or three people to sign. And he said, I don't want to be... prejudicing anything, so don't ask me to sign any of these slips while I'm president. One day in the laboratory, a student went in there and walked up to him and said, I want to join, and would you sign for me? Professor Gomberg hesitated a moment and didn't want to know what to do or say. He was rather modest. And the student says, well, you're a member, aren't you? And he said, yes, and he signed it, never said a word.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I had Anderson, three of the young men, and one of them became very famous, and I became a member of the National Academy and died young. And I just, at the moment, I can't speak his name, but I had all three of them in organic chemistry as laboratory or... recitation assistants, in charge, and Gomberg gave all the lectures. He was a good lecturer, and I enjoyed organic chemistry very much.
When did you make the decision to go to engineering?
Well, we go directly to engineering.
But I meant...
engineering school, first year, you're a general. You check chemical engineering off at the beginning of sophomore year. but we were separate in engineering at all times. We took the same chemistry as the chemists. I guess they took one or two more courses. I think they had to take an extra course in quant, and they had to take the lab, but I took the lab in physical chemistry in the summertime. Professor Bartels, I must say something good about Professor Bartels. I took his colloid course as a graduate student, and I learned surface chemistry, and it was a qualitative one. He brought a man from England as the ACS lecturer there at one of the times, and his lecture was started like this: which is larger, an elephant or a second? And you were asked to write it down. He said the physicists would say the second, and the engineers would say the elephant. But in any event, he said it's like cheese, or these materials of, you know, you can't compare them with Hooke's law or with the viscous flow of fluids. But Bartels was a good teacher in the sense that he let you know what his research was. I don't think the other chemists told us about their research, you know, mm-hmm. not in problems or anything very much. But Bartels did, and I made at least three advances in research in my career based on a feel for surface chemistry. Mm. I don't know if it's the time to mention what they were.
Well, we can while we're talking about that. We'll have to be backing up again, but if you want to...
Well, all right. Let me tell you what they were. First place, he was working in petroleum. He had one of the API grants. On surface properties. He developed a tube with his doctorate students. If you pack a tube with sand, put one fluid in one end, another fluid in the end, and you have the interface between them, and you have a pressure rise on one end and an entrance free atmosphere on the other, you could run wettability. And so you could put water on the downstream and a rise for a capillary tube to see how high it would rise, and oil in there, and water to come in to drive the oil off. He knew about these experiments and ran them, and I learned about them, and I learned what wettability was, adsorption, how you could take a piece of silver and place it five places on the campus and get different relationships with droplets of water or other things. And I had a general feel for it. So when I went to work with Phillips, it was the summer of 1940. I worked for them as an engineer when I went back. And I was working in Oklahoma City in the oil field, and question was whether we should water flood the field or whether we should try to do some other way of getting the secondary recovery. And I went to the well when they were bailing the sand out, and I put it in one of these tubes. And I found out that water could not drive that oil out. Didn't move one iota. And it became clear then that it was oil wet. And this was the first finding of measurement that sand was not water wet always. It was oil wet in this case. And I went on to show that if he drops dry sand in any crude oil and put it in this tube, it lost its water wetness. In other words, if you cannot have asphaltic substances in crude oil, but what they adsorb, and the only way to get them off is to fire it. You can't put a soxlet and extract it off. That was the first one. The second thing I did was mercury, boiling mercury. If you boil mercury with a stainless steel tube, this is a doctor's student of mine, and as you try to boil it, if you add, I visited the General Electric, and they had a mercury boiler, as you may know. And I met the man who found out how to correct the problems they had with it. I went there and visited with him. I was working in the field of liquid metals with the company. And he found out that if you add, I think it's a 0.2% of magnesium and 0.002% of titanium to mercury, it'll wet steel. And so I showed the boiling coefficient when you added the substances as compared to a film boiling without it. And I had this as a paper, one of my doctorate students. I showed it to McAdams, the famous heat transfer man with his book at MIT, and so on. So that was one, and I think I had some understanding of the wettability and the how it worked well. Then the last one was a large problem, which I discussed in my little paper on, and I intended to bring you one, a copy of those, my 1977 70th birthday lecture.
Oh.
And it was that the Bureau of Mines ran the dumping of liquefied natural gas on water. And I was chairman of a committee of the Academy of Sciences Research Council for the Coast Guard on hazardous materials. So they brought the problem to me. They dumped 100 cc's on an aquarium in the lab. And maybe they did it 100 times in the 98th time or something. It blew up, ruptured the glass in the aquarium, but no fire. Nobody got hurt. But it was a shocking experience. They ran 20-gallon dumps on a pond with a 16 millimeter movie, and you run them at the different speeds, but 16-32 per second. And they watched the cloud of LNG go off into the atmosphere and blow away with the wind. Well, I think it was the 14th dump they dumped it on. It came out, it was coming out in the second frame after it hit the water. They likened it to a stick of dynamite. And this was an unknown. They came to me, David Burgess was in charge at the Bureau of Mines in Pittsburgh. He came to me on my Coast Guard committee and asked me, wasn't it hydrates formed or something? No, I said, hydrates don't form and decompose in a 32nd of a second, or whatever it is. And I spent a year. I had Bob Reed at MIT. I had various people. Slepcevich at Oklahoma and Churchill were working on the LNG Pioneer, ship, bringing in liquid methane into England and France. And I talked to a lot of people, and finally I got, I found the Japanese Journal of Physics article in English showing what they call the superheat limit. If you try to heat something at atmospheric pressure, if you heat water, started, and it doesn't boil because it's a liquid-liquid thing. You know, if you try to boil something with another liquid, there's no nucleus for initiating boiling. If you get it up, let's see, critical for methane, for water is about 700 Fahrenheit. If you get it up to about 575, it will spontaneously decompose. Shockwave type. And so we decided that must be what was happening, but why? Well, I got invited to go to the Shell Oil Laboratories in Houston in September of 71. I got there and found some young men, bright young men, had been running this. And they made an experiment where it was very clear. They took a 5-gallon bucket, put a gallon of pentane in it. They had a gallon of LNG on a trunnion, and they put this bucket on some tubifores on a tank, and they put a plexiglass between you and that, and they dumped the gallon of LNG on the pentane, and you had a shotgun report. It knocked the bottom of the cylindrical pink 5-gallon can out. It broke the tubifores, but it didn't rupture the barrel of the can. And it was clear that whatever was happening, it happened now. In this case, it wetted. See, now I was clear. Found what the problem was. They also found that they had to have a certain composition in the tank when they dumped 20 gallons before it would go.
So it was the wettability. It was the wettability of the hydrocarbon, and they showed from their experiments that if it had less than half methane in the LNG, more than half of it was ethane, propane, butane, that it would wet the surface, and the wet the surface heat transfer was so fast it reached this superheat limit of temperature rise, and it went fast. It was a, they say it's a nanosecond. Anyway, see, now I had this feel, the feel, and I attribute it to my work with Professor Bartels.
It's fascinating. You commented that he was the only chemist who let you know about the kind of work he was doing. I get the impression that the chemical engineering faculty were just the opposite.
That's right. That is correct. That is correct. The chemical engineering people let us know of, well, in the first place, our system was this. As an undergraduate, you had to take a research problem, and you had to go to a seminar where you listened to what all the people were doing. As a graduate student, we had a weekly seminar, and you went and heard each doctorate student say what he was going to do, and when he finished, and what he found out. As a student, we had, there were 80 graduate students in 1932. Of them, at least 45 were working on their doctors, see? Brown had 15 at one time working with him. Well, they were working with him, but he didn't have to officially announce anything. You just went to work for a man if you wanted. I could tell you from at the end of a year what everybody was doing, what they were trying to find out. We really knew what the research was going. McCabe was working with crystallization, you see. Baker was working with electroplating and that sort of thing, you see. A.H. White was working with the natural gas or the gas association projects. He was working with heating wood and so on. Brown was working with thermodynamics and equilibria and that sort of thing. And Badger was working with his evaporators, you see. Not only that, but they, in their problems, they would give you a problem they were doing in their consulting work.
I see.
See, we knew they were all doing consulting work too.
You developed that industrial relationship very quickly then with
yes.
When you were doing that.
Matter of fact, Brown had a consulting job with including Phillips, and Ted Legatsky, one of our graduates in the earlier days, had came there and spent 3 months with Brown on that case. So I got acquainted with him, and he was the one who got the Phillips to hire me in late May of 1933.
What kind of laboratory experience did you have as an undergraduate?
Well, you mean in chemistry?
Well,
and in chemical engineering.
Primarily the engineering.
Well, in engineering, we had the fuels lab. Combustion of an oil, a gas analysis. We ran the the ash freezing point, melting point of a coal ash, coal, did things like that in the first lab. We had, of course, a unit operations laboratory where we ran large-scale equipment. We had a salt run that ran for 24 hours trying to make salt from a brine. And we ran heat exchanger equipment and metering, things of this kind. It was a good course in large-scale equipment.
What kind of techs were they using?
Well, we used Walker, Lewis, and McAdams, and I guess a part of the time we were using Badger McCabe's notes. They were getting their book ready.
I see. Okay.
While I was an undergraduate, they didn't finish it. They probably finished it in 33 or 4 after I'd had the course. In thermodynamics, we only had Brown's lectures. No, we used, but well, we used the book, The Man from California. Can't think of his name.
Lewis and Randall?
Yeah, Lewis and Randall, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I later met Randall, but never Lewis. I gave my papers as a young workman. I went to the Chemical Society meetings later on and became as I took my, I'm a 50-year member in 32, I joined Chemical
get industrial engineering chemistry as a student.
What effect did the depression have? This was you were.
I was not depressed, but everyone around me was. My landlady was really losing her house, and I married the landlady's daughter. So later I learned more about that. But my folks were very hard up on the farm. For example, let's see, it would have been in 32. I got my union dues back because I had to pay for it when you registered, and then if you've been there 4 years, they gave it back, and it came to my home in the country. And it was, I don't know, $10 or something. And a check came from to me at home, and I got home one weekend, and my mother said something for you, and I looked at it, and it was a check, and I said, gee, I don't really need this, and I signed it and gave it to her. They went to California while I was a student to see my mother's brother just before he died, and I said, if you go, I'll give you $50. And at the end of 5 years, I had $1,000 in the bank, and I got married that fall, and I had an automobile. So I had done very well. But I saw it, poor people through the restaurant I worked in, and I was aware of it. My wife graduated in 31. She graduated. So she went to be a teacher 31 at Belair, Michigan, and I used to go weekends to see her 3-4 times in a year, and I drove a car up there. I got permission to drive a car home. We had a no driving ban, at the university in those days, and they really did enforce it. Matter of fact, when I got to be a graduate student, and I said, now my wife has graduated, and can't she drive my car? This was before we were married. My girlfriend, can she drive the car and I ride with her? No, you can't do it that way. And I said, oh, I'll give my car to my wife. He said, I couldn't do a thing, man.
You remember any of the other, any of your student colleagues?
Well, yes. We had a group of colleagues. Well, Pete Merkus was a boy from Grand Rapids, Dutch boy. And he and I worked together. I had a project one summer. Phil Brown was often gone in summers, and I kind of ran what he was. What I had done, I did several things, through his office. They sent us a gallon of can of oil and said, tell us what this oil is said to have has an additive of some kind. Can you tell us what it is? And we said, well, that's kind of hard to find out, but I'll try. And we shot for a $500 budget, and I hired Pete Merkus to do part of it. We ran the iodine number, and we ran distillation on the oil, and we ran surface tension, interfacial tensions, and we ran index of refraction. We did all kinds of things. We couldn't find anything. We went down and got a Sears and Roebuck lubricating oil and ran a parallel test. We could see nothing in that difference, but that was a kind of a job I did one summer. And Pete Merkus was my close friend and worked with. He taught me something in his research in an accident he had. He was running the nature of the combustion when he used oxygen in a calorimeter. He was working on the Gas Association Fellowship. And he got in a new pressure gauge that was a differential gauge, like from 300 to 600 pounds, instead of starting at zero. He'd put the gauge on and had his bomb all hooked up, and he was putting his soap solution to be sure he had all the leaks done, and he was doing this at the gauge, and he was doing this, and he'd done this and this and this, and this. He happened to duck down once looking at something on the floor, and the gauge blew out over his head, blew the window out across the narrow laboratory. I entered the room. I heard the noise, and I went up and entered the room, and he sat there, and he was just pale white. And what we found out was the oxygen and the oil left in the Bourdon tube had it reacted explosively.
So Pete became a vice president of Shell, had to retire at age, did a lot of sailing in the Virgin Islands area, and I didn't see much of him, and he's gone. I had Bob Hubbard, who was another classmate. He complained he had to go to Europe one summer and couldn't be with us, with his parents. He didn't finish. He was running a rolling ball viscosimeter with pentane, getting the viscosity. He was there when I came back. Several students were there when I came back. He went to Virginia and taught at Virginia most of his life. Bob did. He's retired, of course, still living there. These people that came back to the university to get a doctor's degree were the ones that really were hurting. Lee Huntington, who went to Oklahoma. To show you how bad it was in the Depression, Lee is a classical example. He had been in the running gasoline plants with a bachelor's degree in Oklahoma. He went to MIT a year. I never knew whether he didn't pass the qualifying or what, but anyway, he came to our place and did a thesis with Brown, and he got his doctor's degree in October of 1933. I had only been at Phillips the summer. I learned he was in town. I said, well, where is he? Well, the director of research was gone and so on, and I said, well, where is he? And he said, well, he's down to the auto lab. I go down to the auto lab, and he was down there cleaning gasoline cans. And I said, Lee, there's something wrong here. I'll try and talk to the management. But that day, the dean, Carson, from Oklahoma, was coming through town looking for a man to head up his department in chemical engineering. And he came to see me. He said, I learned he was here. Should I inquire? And I said, don't worry about your job with Phillips. If they send you cleaning gasoline cans after 10 years in the industry and a doctor's degree, you call them. And he called Carson at Ponca City, got the job, and left. But Don Lindsay had been in industry. He had a family. I think Lee Huntington did too. He finished his degree and he went to Texas A&M. There were quite a few people like this. Roy Wilson went back to the Otto Miller was one of my classmates. He went to be chairman, you know, of Chevron. I was in California when he became vice president for refining, and then I saw him there. I'd worked in California some.
What you mentioned earlier, the connection with Phillips that led to your getting that position. I'd like to explore that a little more. Had you looked at any other possibilities?
Yes, I looked at Texaco. The Texaco man at their laboratory up the river in New York State. Can't think of the town. It's near MIT. I mean, IBM's place. Texaco has their research labs there.
Yeah. Poughkeepsie?
Yeah. I believe it's Poughkeepsie, yeah. Yes, I think that's right. And their man almost had a job for me. He was their California man, Texaco man. And he was very pretty with me. He got acquainted and visited. Phillips headed up the George Oberfell. He headed up the liquefied petroleum gas marketing in the Michigan area, Pontiac and that area. And he had an office in Detroit. I went there and interviewed him. May, let's see, our graduation was June 21st or so. About the 28th of 9th of May, I got a wire, $125 a month. And, of course, I accepted. Carl Kammermeyer, who went to Iowa eventually, got the same wire, but his wife had a job at $110 a month as a secretary at the university, and he said, I can't afford it. Anyway, I went to Phillips, and then on the 23rd of June, 1933,